as human beings, we are conditioned, we are wired to ignore things that are average and discuss things that are different.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. Today we're speaking with Jay Baer, the renowned founder of Convince and Convert, / best-selling author, / sought-after keynote speaker. I could go on. It's going to take about 10 seconds into this conversation to realize how sharp Jay is and his wit as well. We talk about why he wrote his latest, Talk Triggers, why word-of-mouth marketing is going to be increasingly important to the marketer of tomorrow, and how he continues to stay ahead of the curve as a marketer. And of course, we talk about alpacas, plaid suits, and fake IDs, because why not? So let's jump right in, shall we? So Jay, welcome to Future Proof.
Fantastic to be here, Jeremy. I appreciate you taking the time and having me on the show.
Oh my God, absolutely. I think, as one of the top people within the marketing world, so many people speak so highly of you. I think we've met about for a fraction of a second in real life at one of the social freshes, but it's good to have like a real proper conversation that other people get to listen in on. I wanted to talk to you. I guess you've written a whole bunch of books with some great partners, but what inspired you to write Talk Triggers, your most recent work?
It's the same reason why I've written pretty much all of my books, Jeremy. The nice thing is that my firm, Convince and Convert, we do a lot of digital marketing strategy work for big brands around the world. And because of that, I'm in the middle of a lot of companies' decision-making and their struggles or successes as it relates to sort of all things digital and marketing and customer experience. And I write books when I see a pattern emerging. And in this case, what was happening is we were having clients tell us, well, you know, we feel like we've got a better handle now on the mechanics of social or the mechanics of content and the mechanics of digital. But we're not really sure now what stories we should be telling. Like, we know how to create content, but we know what content to be creating. And I'm like, wow, you know, here we are, some of the biggest brands in the world, and they're not really sure what stories to tell. And so sort of the discovery there between myself and Daniel Lemon, who co-authored the book with me, is that we're sort of in this weird storytelling deficit period where everybody's focused on the technology of marketing, not so much the story. And what we realized is that somewhere along the way in the last 10 years or so, we thought that social media equals word of mouth, that we don't need to worry about word of mouth anymore because we have social media. And those two are not the same things. Social media is a way that word of mouth is spread, but social media and word of mouth are quite different. And so we realized that a lot of companies had just said, well, we don't need it anymore. And so we decided to swing the pendulum back the other way and write a book that really focuses on how to do social media and word of mouth on purpose instead of what people are doing today most of the time, which is on accident, if at all.
Yeah. And I think when I wrote my first book, Going Social, that was something where I was trying to say, let's go, quote unquote, do social media, but let's do it towards a goal, towards an objective. And I think you're right. It seems that there are a lot of brands out there that, sure, they would love great word of mouth, but they don't think about what is actually, you know, not newsworthy, but what is something that people want to share, that there'll be some type of value, you know, to the person that they're giving this information to, but also to themselves. Like, what are the things that you want to share that will make you essentially look cool? I feel like everybody in the end wants to, you know, impart some value and look cool in the process.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to turn your customers into a volunteer sales force, a volunteer marketing group, which is essentially what word of mouth does, you have to give them a story to tell. You have to arm them with a tidbit that is easy, interesting, and dynamic for them to pass along to other people. The big mistake that businesses make, Jeremy, and we've been making it for about 10,000 years, is that we assume that competency creates conversation. That if you just run a competent business, that people will naturally tell that story. But that's not actually the way the world works. I don't know all of your listeners. I probably know some of them. But I know this to be true. Nobody has ever said, hey, let me tell you about this perfectly adequate experience I just had. Like, nobody says that because that's a terrible story. It's not a story worth telling. And it's not a story worth listening to. And so you have to give people something to talk about And that thing is typically not your operational brilliance. It is something experiential, something that stands out, something that is noticeable, which is why it's so important in our estimation to actually have a word of mouth strategy that is intended to create conversations instead of just going about your business and saying, well, you know, when I flick the light switch, the lights go off. Therefore, people are going to tell that story.
Yeah. And I think that word of mouth is huge now, but to some extent, it's always been huge. And I think that technology really, in a lot of ways, accelerates that. So obviously the name of the show is Future Proof. How important do you think word of mouth will be to the marketer of tomorrow?
More important than ever if they're paying attention. I mean, already our research shows that 50% of all word of mouth is online, 50% is offline. And you lay on top of that a parallel trend, which shows that we trust each other more than ever, and we trust businesses less than ever. And you think about what that means is that if I recommend something to you, I'm like, hey, it's me, Jay, Jeremy, you should go buy this thing. That carries substantially more persuasive weight than a company saying, we're awesome, click here to let us prove it. You see the whole field of influencer marketing, which essentially is trying to gamify word of mouth in some way. Why is influencer marketing so popular now? It's because traditional top-down, company-created sales messaging is waning in effectiveness and increasing in cost. And so if we look out 5, 6, 8 years, I think word of mouth will be the nucleus of most people's marketing programs, where today it is an adjunct, if anything.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break to go into lightning round, where we ask a few kind of off topic. And
is there a thunder sound effect there that we're supposed to hear? I was waiting.
I need to throw that in there. We've never had that, but I like that. I'm going to steal that idea. We'll give you credit.
So thank you.
Okay, so a few very quick questions, some off topic.
Great.
How do you feel about being the guy to write the first business book with alpacas on the cover?
Well, I feel pretty good about it. The book is about word of mouth. And it's a funny story about that. This isn't going to be a lightning round answer. I apologize.
That's fine.
Our original cover for the book, Talk Triggers, was sort of your perfunctory, mundane business book cover. And we were getting ready to approve it. And Daniel and I said, bro, man, wait a second. Like, this is a book about word of mouth. We should probably do something different that is more talkable than a regular business book cover. And so Daniel, and I will always be grateful for this, just found that image that we have on the cover of two alpacas sort of whispering to one another and mocked up the cover largely in the form that it was ultimately published in. And he sent it to me and he said, what do you think? I'm like, well, I think it's hilarious. I think it's awesome. But there's no way that Penguin, our publisher, will approve that. It's too weird. He's like, well, maybe they will. I'm like, no. He's like, just send it over. I'm like, okay. So I email it to Penguin, and I think some people were on vacation, which was the real win there, because they came back and said, yeah, it's great, go for it. And the rest is history. And so now, because I do think we were the first business book with alpacas on the cover, the good news, bad news of that is I'm looking around my office right now and it is festooned with alpaca related items. Now people send me a lot of alpaca stuff all the time, which is kind of awesome.
That's hilarious.
I should have tequila on the cover and people be sending me tequila all the time, but next book.
Yeah. My next book will have Teslas on the cover. I'll see if that works.
Gold.
So I know you've written a lot. What's your favorite? I mean, for me, it's kind of like finding random coffee shops to write. But what's your favorite place to write? Airplane, coffee shop, at home, combination?
So I pretty much, for each book, I pick a location and I write the whole book in the same location. And this book I wrote, we have a house on a lake about 25 minutes from our regular house here in southern Indiana. And so I wrote 98% of Talk Triggers at the lake, which is a very peaceful way to write a book. No people, no distractions, looking at the water. It was great. The previous book, Hug Your Haters, I wrote at the Law Library at Indiana University here in Bloomington. So each one I pick a location and I find it works better for me when I have the same location for the whole book. It just helps with the narrative flow and kind of gets me into the mood of writing. I also, and this is not the question you asked, but it's the question I'll answer. I also write books a little differently, I think, than some people. So when I decide to write a book, I figure out the due date and then I work backwards and I say, okay, when am I traveling? When can I not write it? And then I just put it on my calendar. And so it's like 6 months in advance. I'll be like, okay, on this Saturday, I need to write 4,500 words, and I calendar it 4,500 words. And on this Tuesday night, when I'm done working, I'm going to have dinner with the family. And then from 8 to 10, I'm going to write 2,000 words. And I literally calendar the whole thing out like a half year in advance and just follow that script.
That's insane, but also impressive. So hats off.
Well, it's the only way I can do it. Like a lot of people are like, well, you know, I've got a consulting firm. And what I do is take like a mini sabbatical for 3 months or whatever and write the book. I'm like, I can't do that. Or at least I should say I'm not willing to do that. People ask me like, where does the time come from to write the books? And the reality is it comes from my family.
Yeah, which is no, not, totally, you know, that's it.
That's the real answer.
I mean, I just sold my agency, and for me, it was like, yeah, that was my main baby as opposed to my actual family. So yep. Kind of realized that, you know, something's got to give, but like, it's true. It's a balancing act. So, okay. So let's get something more irreverent. What's one thing about you we would never guess that you've never admitted to in an interview ever?
About anything?
Yeah. I mean, about yourself, not like okay. A little known right. fact about Indiana is...
Yeah. No, I don't really know that many Indiana facts, actually. Okay, something I've never admitted to in an interview. I've never admitted this in an interview. I freshman year of college, I made all my spending money by creating a fake ID laboratory in my dorm room. So people would come in and I had a Polaroid camera and a big poster board and an iron and some laminates and I would make fake IDs. And that's how I made my spending money in college until I was at one of the local watering holes and I was like four guys back from the door and the bouncer says to the other bouncer, damn, there's a lot of kids from Idaho at this school. And I knew that it was time to get out of the business because I was making fake Idaho driver's licenses. I went back to my dorm and threw away all my supplies and got out before the law caught up to me. Also, weird fun fact, there's only two states I have never been to, Hawaii and Idaho. Even though I made a few hundred Idaho driver's licenses, I've never been to the state of Idaho.
That's hilarious. I feel like they need to give you an honorary citizenship right. or ID yeah, there. Like
a key to the city or whatever, a key to the state. Yeah.
That's I so agree. Funny. So that's a pretty good one. How about, and maybe last one we'll do, who is the number one marketer that inspires you? You know, just first person to come to mind. Don't worry about offending everybody else.
Oh, I won't worry about offending anybody. The marketer that inspires me, there really are so many because I'm fortunate to have intersected with a lot of interesting folks over the years. You know, somebody who I really, really love, who doesn't get the credit he deserves, and he's a brilliant, brilliant marketer and a fantastic man, is Bruce Turkel. Bruce is a branding specialist in Miami, has a series of books, a terrific agency, is an outstanding public speaker and a really, really good person. So I like Bruce and his work an awful lot. But boy, I tell you what, I could name 150 off the top of my head, probably.
No, it's true. That's one of the nice things about going out there, speaking a lot, being at conferences and everything is you encounter a lot of really great people. But actually, another thing you encounter a lot and bringing it back to word of mouth a little bit is, you know, you touched upon social media and how it has this ability to build word of mouth. But what do you think about social media's ability to build word of mouth, for lack of a better term, stupid things like Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper? What's the deal with them? Or the latest Kardashian thing that I don't care about? What's the negatives associated with it? And do you think that social media just naturally builds a negative word of mouth and becomes a little bit of a cesspool, or am I just pontificating here?
I think there's two pieces to that. One, social media has certainly become in the more recent past a place where our basest instincts can be acted upon, right? If you just look at Twitter, you look at YouTube comments, you look at even Facebook, it has gotten increasingly negative. Now, I don't know that is social media's fault, more so than social media is a mirror that we put up to increasing polarization in society at large. But I liked what Dave Kirpin did recently. He relaunched his book, Likeable Social Media, third edition, a couple weeks ago, and he proclaimed, I think it was February 26th, you know, Likeable Social Media Day, and this idea of let's really try and be positive in social and sort of take back social from the sort of negative cloud that it seems to be operating under. That's a big lift, obviously, but I like the premise. in terms of the frivolity of social, kind of the other side of your question, I also don't think that's really social's fault, right? I mean, I think social media is the way that popular culture spreads in a lot of ways, and is in some ways created and formed. And I guess for good or bad, if we have all decided that we want to talk mostly about Bradley Cooper and the Kardashians, then social media allows us to do so. So I don't think social is shaping society as much as it is a reflection of society.
No, and I think that in large ways, that's a really good point. I think that, you know, the interesting thing about word of mouth is I think it's very in the moment. It's not kind of like, things that I, at least, you know, that I've noticed is word of mouth is really good with what restaurant should I check out right now? You know, like what concert should I consider going to in the near future? And mm-hmm. word of mouth doesn't necessarily work really well for, let's talk about, let's say, global warming, climate change, because it's far out there. And it's not something that it's not as much fun as talking about like celebrity right. gossip.
Right. It's a lot to contend with. Yeah. I mean, if you think about just how we spend our time and how media is created, this is not an era that is devoted to, you know, being very thoughtful. It's just not, right? That's not the place that we're at right now, at least in this country. And I think social media reflects that.
So talking about a social media, but obviously there are a lot of other technology levers that a brand can pull to get a message out there. I mean, how can you use technology to encourage, something to, I don't want to say go viral, God forbid, how to encourage something to build word of mouth?
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways. One is understanding what your word of mouth strategy is, right? So in the parlance of our book, understanding what your talk trigger is, like what is the thing, what is the experience that you give people that is intentionally different that you want them to notice and talk about? And then wherever possible, in a way that's not over the top, but at least is also noticeable, how do you amplify that differentiator in social? So I'll give you an example. One of the most famous and perhaps longest lasting word of mouth successes in history is DoubleTree Hotel's chocolate chip cookie. Everybody who checks into the hotel gets a warm chocolate chip cookie. They've been doing that every day for 30 years. Today and tomorrow, yesterday, they give out about 75,000 cookies every day worldwide. We did a survey of DoubleTree guests for the book, and we found that 34% of them have told a story to somebody else about that cookie. Now, that means, if you're going to run the math on that, that today and tomorrow and the next day, about 22,500 stories a day are told about this chocolate chip cookie. Now, on a parallel track, when's the last time you saw a DoubleTree ad? Not very often, yeah. Because the cookie is the ad and the guests are the marketing department at some level. However, if you look at what they do in social, every once in a while, it's not every post, but it's with some degree of frequency, they're sharing chocolate chip cookie recipes. They're sharing photos of the cookies. They're sharing videos of the cookies being made. All of their airport shuttles have graphics of chocolate chip cookies on them.
And, you know,
they're just kind of nudging. It's okay. They're just sort of nudging people to remember, oh, yeah, they're the cookie guys.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the thing that I don't know, you can't like really A-B test history, but I think that what's interesting to me is they essentially got in on the cookies and pushing the cookies within their social and within their marketing more after it became an accepted thing for their clientele to talk about it
for
and
sure.
to think about
oh,
it.
Yeah.
So I mean, I would say, do you think that a brand can actually proactively use social and other technologies to push something to become word of mouth, or does it almost have to become word of mouth before the brand then gets in on the participation?
Oh, no, absolutely. We do it all the time. And that's a lot of the consulting that we do at Convince and Convert is help brands figure out their talk trigger and then how to amplify that trigger in social. The other thing that social is really important for as it relates to word of mouth is doing deep social listening, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, what have you, Yelp, TripAdvisor, other ratings and review sites, and seeing exactly what customers are talking about today. Because in many cases, what you'll find is you may already have a differentiator and you didn't even know it was that big of a deal to customers. But when they mention it routinely, you're like, oh, they really do think this is a special experience. And then you can kind of, you know, operationalize that a little bit more, or take it to the next level. And then it really becomes your primary word of mouth strategy. So that's really one of the first things we do, is we do some deep listening to figure out, okay, you know, what's the customer conversation around this brand, this business today? And is there a kernel of a differentiator already that we can then just add layers to and then turn it into a full-fledged word of mouth strategy?
So also, I think what's interesting is, you know, technology is obviously very important about building, you know, getting word of mouth out there, but you get out there and speak a lot. And I've even heard friends of friends tell me about something that they've heard you speak about. So it's clear that you're very good at trying to inspire word of mouth, right? So as a speaker, how do you intentionally try to build word of mouth and try to essentially tell people a message in a way that that it's going to be syndicated further? I mean, besides being a snazzy dresser, you know, what are the other secrets or the ways you intentionally try to do that?
Yeah, so the dresser thing is certainly part of it, right? So I always wear rambunctious plaid suits on stage, always, every time. And now we lean into that quite a bit. So actually reworking some graphics on my website right now to make it more plaid. Our thank you gift for meeting planners is a plaid blanket. My favorite talk trigger now for me is before I give a presentation, my team sends an email to the meeting planner to go to a website, which is dressjbayer.com. And the meeting planner is able to select which color suit I wear. And then it goes on my calendar, so I know what to pack when I'm traveling. So we're sort of aligned around the suit thing as the thing that meeting planners notice and talk about. On stage, in terms of audiences, there's definitely some things that I do in the presentation that are different and memorable. I use a lot of audio and almost no video, which is really unusual. Very few people do that, and people talk about that a lot. But I think the most important thing, and this is sort of something I learned from Chris Brogan a long time ago, which was you've got to give your ideas handles. And what he means by that is you have to take the premise and break it down into small enough parts that people can easily remember it and share it. So what people say of me a lot about my work on stage is that I give presentations that are essentially a series of tweets. And that is true. I have very few words on the slide, and each point is sort of quotable and shareable on its own. So if you want to share the whole presentation, that's great. But if you wanted to share this one sentence, that's great too. And back in the day, when people would live tweet conferences constantly, that was really, really effective. Almost nobody does that anymore. But I still communicate the same way on stage in a presentation. It allows those ideas to spread more easily.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting because it kind of naturally makes sense. If you're somebody who studies word of mouth, then you are going to be better at getting it out there. And, you know, how about content and podcasts? It's kind of same question. How do you try to intentionally think about how your content can build word of mouth? And one thing that I noticed that I think you do well, which is also think about that tweet-worthy content. So breaking things down, having click-to-tweet buttons. But, I mean, from a structural standpoint, how do you think about intentionally about what types of content you get out there in order to try to build word of mouth?
One of the things that we are really keen on for our clients and for ourselves is this idea of eliminating random acts of content. Too many people sort of say, here's a thing, let's do this thing, and then we're going to do this other thing, and then we're going to do this other thing. And it's all sort of this loosely tied together collection of whatever. We think in shows, and this is how we help our clients think as well, that all the content you create today, fundamentally, other than sort of a one-off, you know, customer service tweet or whatever, needs to be a series of shows. So we have four different shows in our company, and then we have the blog, which is also a very consistent editorial calendar, and our newsletter, which works the same way. So on the show side, we have Social Pros, which is my primary podcast, which we've been doing for 9 years. And the wisdom on that show is that we keep it to a very specific audience, right? It is the podcast for people who are big brand social media managers, period. Like that's the show. So could we have a bigger show if we change the audience focus? We could, but we want to be the show for that audience. I tell people this all the time, Jeremy. People ask me a lot, like, hey, should I start a podcast? Should I start a blog? Should I write a book or whatever? I'm like, well, yeah, maybe, but here's the thing. the only way your podcast, your book, your blog, your video series, whatever, can really be successful is if it is somebody's favorite example of that thing in the world. If you're not anybody's favorite, what you're doing is not specific and relevant enough. So I think the mistake that most people make is they think of their audience as too big, and instead it should be tighter, smaller, narrower, more specific, because then you become exactly the show that that person is looking for. So that's what we do with Social Pros. It's a show for that audience. My new show, which I just started a month ago, is called Talk Triggers, the Talk Triggers Show. And what we're doing there is sort of a different approach, which is to say, look, different people prefer content in different modalities. So each episode is only 6 minutes long because some people like short form. It's a video. It's also on LinkedIn. It's also on Twitter. It's also on Instagram. It's on Facebook. It's a podcast. Like you can access that content essentially any way that content can be accessed today. And that's 100% intentional, because if you want it this way, we'll give it to you that way. So those are some of the things that we think about day to day. I'm lucky that I've got a department in our company that really runs our media division, and they spend a lot of time optimizing for these kind of things.
No, I think it's, you guys definitely do one of the better jobs out there with kind of the intentionality of the content that you put out. Yeah, which I think, is a practice what you preach, right? You know, one thing that's interesting is we've done a lot of work the last few years, or my former company, which is now Proponent. We're actually going to have a show on that in the near future. But
oh, cool.
Yeah. And what can you tell us about today's younger consumers? Because we've done a lot of focus on Gen Z and millennials. And I'm wondering, do they use word of mouth differently? How do they use word of mouth? And what does that tell us about how to build a future-proof brand? Because those are the customers of tomorrow.
Yeah, we have some extraordinary research called Chatter Matters, the 2018 word of mouth report that we conducted last year, very significant national research study on the impact of word of mouth. And what we found, Jeremy, is that as the consumer gets younger, the role of word of mouth in their life becomes even more important, and their likelihood to use word of mouth to make buying decisions goes up and up and up. So it's so on trend now. That's kind of why we wrote the book when we wrote it. It's so on trend now that you know, not only is word of mouth more important because we trust people, not companies, but the younger you are, the more you trust each other and the less you trust companies, and the more word of mouth matters. So you think about all these businesses who are thinking about, okay, how do we tap into Gen Z? And that's the future of your customer base. Well, how you tap into Gen Z is word of mouth, and also influencers, because they rely on influencers for buying cues far disproportionately to other cohorts and other generations. So that's one of the reasons why I think we are, you know, even though word of mouth has been around since cavemen, literally, I feel like we're just starting to get into this new era, almost a reawakening of the power of word of mouth, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah. And I also say, I mean, one of the best things about having kids is you get to think through the lens of people who grew up
in
very different experience. I say, I mean, I love my kids, but I love them even more because they're valuable to me as a marketer.
Yeah. R&D lab. Right. Yeah. My youngest is going to college in September. And I'm going to have to like adopt a middle schooler or something, because I'm gonna lose my laboratory.
That's insane. So you must have started early. Yeah, I started late.
No,
so.
I'm disproportionately youthful looking. I'll be 50 this year. So
very nice. Very cool. Well, still, I've got a 5.5-year-old and I've got a while
no,
to
thank
go.
You.
Yeah. Yeah.
God bless you. Yeah.
I know. It's a lot of.
Get back to me in 2030. Tell me how it's going.
A lot of gray hairs coming in right now, you know. So and one or two other questions. So how. I know you talk about same being lame, but is that something that you think will continue forever in the future? Like, is that endemic to, you know, the human condition that same is lame, or is that just the world we live in now and you might see some kind of return to people not doing crazy things just to get attention or whatever? Like,
yeah, well, we say same is lame, and the parallel construct that we say is that the more you try to fit in, the more your customers will tune out. We say that in the context of trying to create conversations on purpose. And it's just because of the physiological truth, which is that as human beings, we are conditioned, we are wired to ignore things that are average and discuss things that are different. So when you are having an experience, there is a pattern and you expect to see that pattern. if that pattern is deviated from in some way, then that becomes noticeable because it's not part of the pattern that you anticipated. I don't think that will change because that is a physiological reality more so than a marketing or a business reality. Now, what I hope changes, to your point, is that people stop trying to go viral. And one of the things that we emphasize in the book and I emphasize on stage with clients is that word of mouth strategy is not about going viral. That's not what I preach and that's not what I do. What we're looking for is an operational differentiator, something that you do different day to day in your business that customers notice and then talk about every day, week, month, quarter, year. It's not about let's rent an elephant for the afternoon and walk them down Main Street so the radio station comes and covers it. That's public relations, right? That's stunt marketing. And there's a place for that, for sure. But it's not what I do. And it's not what we recommend. So being different for different's sake is not the goal. Being different enough that your customers notice it and talk about it reliably and repeatably, that's the goal.
Yeah. I think it has to be aligned with ultimately where you're trying to get to. And I think as opposed to just, like you said, doing something for something's sake. I mean, anybody can, you know, throw a few random words at the wall and say like, hey, why don't we, you know, have a, you know, give a giraffe a stuffed animal to everybody who walks through the door. And I'd be like, well, is that connected to what you're trying to be known for it? Or is it just a thing that people will talk about, but won't actually get you closer to your goal?
It has to be relevant. It's one of the four, there's four principles of a talk trigger, four requirements that we talk about in the book. And one of them is relevancy, that your talk trigger should ideally tie into the context of who you are and what you're about. And I'll tell you a quick story about that if we got a minute. So we talked about the DoubleTree cookie thing, right? So DoubleTree cookies, they give the warm chocolate chip cookie to every guest, right? That's their thing. Well, there's another story in the book from a guy who's a locksmith. His name's Jay Sofer. He's the number one rated locksmith in all of New York City. And he's one of the highest rated businesses on Yelp in all of New York, regardless of business type, which is a pretty high bar to clear. I think you'll agree. Here's his talk trigger. After he finishes rekeying your apartment or whatever, he performs a full security audit of your premises, checks every window, every door, makes some recommendations, and does it all for free. That's his talk trigger. That is an operational choice that he has made to do something different that customers do not expect because it deviates from the anticipated pattern. And subsequently, customers talk about it and share that story with their friends. You see mentions of it all over Yelp, etc. But I want you to imagine, Jeremy, that the last two stories I mentioned were reversed. So imagine that Jay Sofer comes to your apartment and he finishes rekeying your place. And he says, Jeremy, hey, before I go, would you like a warm chocolate chip cookie that I baked in my locksmith van? You would say, I do not want that. That is a thing that I'm not interested in. And how exactly do you have an oven? How do you have an oven in your locksmith van? That totally sketches me out. Or conversely, imagine you go to DoubleTree, right? And they say, Mr. Goldman, thank you for being here. Appreciate it. Before you go to your room, would you like us to perform a thorough security audit of that room? You would say, if that is required, I would like to check out now, please. So each of these talk triggers works exceptionally well because they are relevant to the business. It's not about conversation for conversation's sake. It is an operational choice, yes, but it's an operational choice that makes sense in the context of who they are and what they offer to the marketplace.
Yep, totally makes sense the way you put it that way. And I really like that analogy. Two last questions for you, Jay. And I think that these are things I try to ask a lot of people. How do you get better at predicting the future on an ongoing basis? And I ask that because you're somebody who I think has consistently identified things that are going to matter to the brand of tomorrow, to the marketer of tomorrow, a little bit ahead of other people. So I think that you don't need to call yourself a futurist, but I think that you are responsible for identifying trends before everybody else knows about these things. So how do you get better at doing that on an ongoing basis?
I'm not good at it, actually. I'm not a futurist. I'm not a trend predictor. But what I am good at is pattern recognition. We mentioned patterns a moment ago. I am good at seeing something and saying, oh, well, this connects to this other thing, and then noticing that pattern, but more than anything else, translating that into a way that more people find it accessible. So I don't find myself to be a futurist or a trend predictor, but I think I really am a translator of patterns to the public. It really, really helps to continue to be involved with clients every day and doing this kind of work all the time and speaking at conferences and interacting with other professionals. Even though our company is all virtual, I am enveloped with really smart ideas and smart people all the time. And I wouldn't have it in any other way. I think it would be really difficult to see these patterns if I wasn't doing the actual work that I'm doing, and I'm really grateful for it.
I love that. I think one other quick question along those lines I want to ask you is just about, you know, futurism and identifying trends in general. I think that everybody within the marketing world, but in general, we all have certain biases. And I don't mean politically or ideologically. I mean that there are certain things where if you're a drones expert, you want to believe that drones are going to, you know, sure, be the biggest thing ever, and they're going to happen tomorrow. So with anything that anybody's an expert in, I think that we have incentives to believe that this thing is important. So how do you, how do you correct or control for your own biases in order to better, you know, you don't have to say predict the future, but connect things together and add value for clients and your audiences around the world?
I think part of the thing that helps us is that we don't proclaim anything until we've actually seen it and done it with clients. As I mentioned, we wrote this book because clients were asking us the same question over and over. So because we're not really way out in front, I feel like to some degree we're not bias proof, but we're certainly bias insulated a little bit because we're not looking into a crystal ball, right? It's early, but it's not so early that we're really taking a lot of risk on being right or wrong. But there's no question that you know, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I feel like I probably ought to be better at that than I am. I think what really helps, frankly, is that we have a whole team of strategists that are smarter than I am about these kind of things. And I may say something's true, and this happens with great regularity, and they say, that's not actually true. Like that, I know you want that to be true, but clients don't think that's true, and that's not actually how it works in the real world. And it's having that kind of feedback loop and a company that's comfortable with one another and with me enough to say, nah, that's just bullshit, is really, really great.
I love that. I think it's really important to surround yourself with people like that. And it's great that even though you've achieved more than a lot of people at your young age of almost 50, but I think that a lot of people can learn from that. You know, stay humble and keep some good people around you, and you're going to constantly grow and challenge your own biases and your own previous conclusions as a result.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've gotten better at in the past too is it's just bringing different perspectives on the team, right? You know, there's this, you know, people talk about diversity, but it really does matter. Not only diversity of background and geography in our case, but age as well. I mean, we're trying to get more Gen Z and millennial folks on the team because they just look at the world differently, and their relationship with technology is so different than mine. I mean, I had a typewriter in college, like for real, right? So, you know, it's a different world. And having all those perspectives on the team just makes you a lot better.
I mean, I had to do my college applications on a typewriter, so I'm dating myself too. Yeah. And I think there are a lot of people right now listening who are probably going to Google the term typewriter.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, seriously. But anyway. Yeah.
And now everything's voice activated, right? We're not even going to need hands. We're just going to have flippers because we're not going to need hands to type. So we'll just use voice interfaces.
So you heard it here first. Jay is predicting.
That's my prediction. That is my future prediction.
Flippers in the near future. I love it. Jay, I'll let you go now. But thank you so much. This was really informative.
Jeremy, thanks so much. I appreciate you.
Thanks so much, Shea Bear. I told you he wouldn't disappoint, and was I right or was I right? And also, thanks to all of you out there for rating us, reviewing us, and recommending us to others. All of your support helps others find our show, and we really appreciate it. I'd like to also welcome some new team members. Future Proof is produced by Sarah Walker Santana, and our show was edited this week by Jason Stack. Until next time, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.